And a good evening to you, and welcome to the first of a new series of programs on your living Bill of Rights. This is year number three, unless Scott Crichton corrects me on the air tonight about this. It is the third year, is it, Scott? Good, very good. And we bring these programs to you each month during the year, except for the summer. And during the first 2 years, we've had a number of listeners ask us why we don't talk about how people, meaning I think judges and justices, interpret the Constitution. What are the different values that go into that? And tonight we've invited two Billings-based attorneys, Kyle Gray and Mark Parker, to come into our studio, along with Scott Crichton of the American Civil Liberties Union of Montana, to explore how to interpret the Constitution. Judges, politicians, and citizens have differed on the meaning of our Constitution from the very beginning, especially the Bill of Rights. And we don't expect tonight to arrive at any consensus on this topic, but it is useful to hear perspectives and to air perspectives on how we relate the Constitution to the human condition some 200 years after the document was written and ratified. You may recall back in the 20s or 30s, there was a sociological view that what the justice had for breakfast, or what he or she had, I guess it was he's in those days, had as a diet generally, or their mental health condition, or their general happiness or unhappiness, had a major impact on how they interpreted the Constitution. Another view suggests that if you are fundamentally an optimist or you are fundamentally a pessimist, that will determine how you interpret the Constitution. And then we hear terms, more often than we realize, perhaps, terms such as strict construction or original intent, the latter concept being one that has been endorsed by President Bush to help him in selecting nominees for the Supreme Court. He has mentioned the original intent doctrine as one of his guiding principles in selecting people for the court. So we're going to talk about this and all of this tonight and a lot more, asking you in a little while to join us in this discussion. And we're going to begin with some introductory comments, first from Kyle Gray and then from Mark Parker, and then we'll be off with our listeners. Kyle?
Well, thank you, Marvin. I guess I'll just start out by saying I'm not a big believer in original intent. I think it raises more questions than it can ever answer. The first question being, whose intent are we looking for? Especially when we're talking about how the Bill of Rights is read against the states, the original framers didn't intend for it to be. That's a concept that arose out of the Reconstruction era after the Civil War. And in trying to find out the intent of the Reconstruction legislators who came up with the language of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, you get in a morass. And even when you take it back further, if you go back and try to figure out what the framers of the Constitution meant certain words to mean, you run into the problem that it was a secret convention. And so we don't really know. The only thing we have is Madison's notes that weren't even published until 1840. And those are not helpful on many things. And Madison himself said that the intent of the framers of the Constitution was not particularly important. Rather, we should look to the ratifiers of the Constitution, meaning the various state legislatures at that time. And, of course, we don't have much from those either. So it's a difficult process to begin with. And even if you could do it, I'm not convinced you can. It makes sense. I think it makes about as much sense to try and guide our lives by the exact words written down in the 18th century as it does to bring this up to today, for the Taliban to tell people they have to live exactly by words written down in the 7th century. We all live in now, at least we do in this country, a post-industrial era that could not be envisioned by folks who were living in at around the time of the framing of the Constitution. And so I think we need definitely to look beyond original intent for the Constitution to continue to be the living, brilliant document that it has been.
Well, Mark, if you're in total agreement with that, we can shut down and go home. But I suspect you're not.
No, I'm not in agreement. If we untether ourselves from the task of trying to figure out what the intent of the Constitution is, we might as well throw the document out altogether. all three of the speakers here tonight have brought a copy and are going to be looking at it and trying to divine therefrom what it meant. Maybe not what it meant to Madison or Washington or some of the other individuals that were there, but what it meant to the people that ratified it at the time. If we don't do that, we might as well abandon the task entirely of constitutional interpretation and make it up as we go along. This program is called the Living Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights was never meant to be living. It was meant to be dead. And Scalia, when he was here, Justice Scalia, he campaigns for the dead Bill of Rights, as do I. Because if it's living and breathing and changing and evolving, it is a very dangerous weapon in the hands of whoever has given it. Now, we're not going to be perfect, and it is difficult. No two umpires know where the strike zone is, but they at least agree that they're going to give a good faith effort to try to find where it is. No two judges look at any law the same. They are governed by all of their various prejudices, without doubt, but they still have to adhere to a central proposition that they have to apply the law as intended. If not, we have some problems on our hands. And society has changed a lot since the founders sat in Philadelphia and drafted the Constitution, but it hasn't changed that much, really. If you read the law from the time, the cases from the time, the central issues that bothered people then are the ones that are bothering them now. And I can tell you that the founders did intend for debates like this to take place. And in fact, that's exactly what they had in mind. And if it weren't for their intent and our adherence to it, we wouldn't be here today. So I'm all for trying to discern what the intent is, although it is difficult.
Well, you're not in complete disagreement with Kyle. I mean, you would agree it's living, and Mark says it's dead. So let's find out what those mean as we go down the road. We do have phone numbers, 657-2941. If you would like to join in this discussion, you live in the Billings area, either with a question or with a comment. You may have a Constitution beside you at home. And if you do, you can certainly lend your point of view to this discussion, or you can raise questions. And if you live outside the Billings area, 1-800-441-2941. What do you think accounts primarily for how people differ? I mentioned some differences of worldview, differences of fundamental constitution as a person. Whether one is an optimist or a pessimist, one could say some people think that people are naturally liberal or conservative in terms of the kind of personalities they are. Does all this stuff go into interpreting the Constitution, or should we try to do what some people would refer to in the Bible as a close to textual analysis and as literal interpretation as possible? Is that really what we're aiming for when we talk about original intent, Mark?
Well, we do both. Everybody brings to reading any document every life experience that they've ever had. However, they can still adhere to the central proposition and goal, and that is it meant something, and they have to figure out what it means, and they have to try in good faith to figure out what it means fairly. And do people have prejudices? Of course. If I go to a football game and have 5,000 well-meaning, honest people on Billings West side and 5,000 well-meaning people on Billings Senior side, a call by an umpire is going to be booed and cheered by those people, and they will swear the next day that they actually saw the event differently because of the prejudices of their team they want to win. Having said all that, we want fair umpires. We want them to step on the field and say, today I will read that rule, and I'm going to try to figure out its intent, and I'm going to make my level best to enforce it.
So we like judicial interpretations that agree with our principles in general.
Well, of course. we like them. That doesn't mean, just because my personal preference for dozens of decisions is a lot different than whether or not I believe that that's what the law should be.
Well, let me ask you this, Mark. I was at the same speech you were, where Justice Scalia spoke, and he's certainly...
But I didn't have my arms folded.
He's certainly a very engaging speaker. And I enjoyed his talk. And he, actually, I've had a grudging admiration for him over the years because of the justices who speak as often as he does about original intent. He meant it. There are some, the flag burning case is a yeah. good example. He at that time said, you know, he really abhors people who burn flags, but the way he reads the Constitution, because it's a form of speech, he had to agree that even though it's a speech he hated, it's protected speech. And so at that time I thought, okay, this is fine. But then we get Bush v. Gore, and I guess I would like to ask Mark if he sees a
we'll bit get to that. We'll get
of
to Bush.
Original intent.
Yeah, we'll get to Bush and Gore later on. I don't want to get us off on that right away because the whole program could be devoted
right.
to that one case.
That's probably a good point. But I guess what I'm saying is if you're going to have a judicial philosophy like that, you have to apply it consistently.
Sure.
And Justice Scalia has done it better than most, but even he has his, I guess you would call them off days if you wanted to be kind.
Scott, you're my co-host, co-creator, actually, of these programs. It was originally your suggestion, I think, that got us started on this, and I'm going to give you a chance to make some introductory remarks, but then we're going to take three calls in a row here from Billings, Helena, and Laurel. But you have the floor for...
Well, thanks, Marvin, and again, thanks to you and KEMC for airing this series again this season. I've had some discussions with people in other radio stations who think that my sitting here makes it not an objective discussion that we're having. So,
well, I think you're totally objective, as am I.
I'll do my best to defer to the experts here. I'm not a scholar, and I'm not a lawyer. I've spent a fair amount of my adult life, though, working around organizations that have needed the help of groups like ACLU and worked with ACLU now for 13 years. And it's my sense that we are talking about a living document and an experiment in democracy that is that's fresh and new almost every day. So... I think that part of that depends on the personalities that are sitting on the bench that are helping to interpret the law, as well as the people who are making the arguments. But it's my sense that we really do have to try to be present tense when we're applying a document that is over 200 years old, and we use it as a guided post, as a beacon. But I think that the light that it sheds depends on the distance from the source. And the further we get away from the 17th century, the more we have to be creative as we look at, for example, free speech as it applies to cyberspace. I mean, I don't know where original intent would come down in trying to sift through how decisions relating to that are based on the intent of the founders. So
later on, Mark will clarify that.
I'm sure he will. So
I can clarify that.
I'm sure you will. So again, thanks for everybody for participating.
We have callers on the line from Billings, Laurel, and Helena, and we're going to listen to all three of them in a row here. Billings, you're first. Hello, Billings.
Yes. Good evening.
You're the first one. Go ahead.
Thank you. How do folks with the philosophy of original intent reconcile that philosophy with the fact that the Constitution has been amended 23 or 24 times and it didn't provide suffrage for women or basic civil rights for minorities? Thank you.
Okay, that's keep that to make a note of that and keep it in mind, and we'll move on to our next call from Laurel. Good evening.
Hi, good evening. I'd like to get to specifics. This is a wonderful program here, and I think what you ought to do is take one amendment a week until you go through the first 10.
Well, we have been doing that only one a month, and we'll get back to that routine. We're doing this program tonight because so many people over the first 2 years of these monthly programs asked us to do a program on how, in general, one should interpret the Constitution, because that's sort of been implicit in a lot of other programs. But go ahead.
Well, I agree with this last speaker, the ACLU man. I was thinking particularly of the First Amendment and the separation of church and state, and how that concept actually grew out of the First Amendment that reads, Congress shall make no act respecting an establishment of religion, thanks to Thomas Jefferson's comment, and then thanks to William O. Douglas in a Supreme Court decision. That's kind of become embedded in constitutional law. And the interesting implication of that is, I know there's a big discussion that I encounter among free thinkers. They would like to interpret the that statement in the First Amendment to mean that they have a freedom from religion as well as a freedom to not to join in a state religion. And I just wonder how far you can take that interpretation. Are they? What do you think? Should that be a position that should be allowed? I remember the President President Bush Sr., when he was in his vice presidential campaign, said that he didn't think that atheists qualify as U.S. citizens. But I know there's a lot of there was a lot of opposition to that, and I wonder whether, in the end, it's public opinion really that shapes these decisions, which become precedent in interpreting the constitutional amendments.
Just a response
from a couple of your speakers.
Sure. You would think, from a lot of public discussion, the assumption is that everybody has a faith and one that can be labeled, and yet I recall in the letters that were exchanged between Thomas Jefferson and John Adams late in their lives, one of the statements Jefferson made in debate through the mails, of course, which took weeks for one point of view to be expressed, was whether you have a God or whether you have no God, neither picks my pocket nor breaks my bones. And I would suggest that that's the statement of somebody who doesn't have a specific ideological faith, although they may have what would Jefferson called a deist, I think, for the most part. But you're right. I mean, there isn't much of a provision in our public speech or in our assumptions that there are people out there who have no faith. We're going to move on to a caller from Helena. Go ahead.
Helena? Hi, thanks.
Yes. Go ahead.
First of all, I guess I just would say that years and years ago, I used to be kind of a, you know, essentially a strict constructionist, having read a lot of historical things, you know, and believing in the revolution and all that. But over time, I've kind of come to the point of view that really it has to be a living and moving document. It has to represent the changes of the times. I mean, otherwise we're doing essentially what the Taliban is trying to do, you know, is pick something in time and space and giving it no room to grow. Well, we've certainly seen that our Constitution, our basic law, has to grow. And then separate from that, it also seems to me like the founders were very much revolutionaries. They believed that we ought to be way more revolutionary in dealing with our government than we have been. They felt that this kind of entrenchment that we've, you know, that we've lived in and perpetuated for whatever it's been, almost 300, well, going on 300 years, is going to be the downfall of a living democracy. So, and then at some point my wife pointed out to me that really the Constitution and law itself is not the law of the land until the court has reviewed it. And then the court looks at it from the point of view of other case law and so forth, and other constitutional law. So I guess those kinds of things lead me to feel that we're on a pretty good track, mostly, in being willing to let our Constitution grow as we grow. And I really like, I mean, over time, as I've watched the court and seeing how they review and reflect on not only law but the Constitution, I guess I've really become to appreciate that too, that the court has a totally separate agenda, I guess you'd say, from either the executive branch or the legislative branch, and that agenda is, well, I mean, I'll be Pollyanna enough to say that that agenda is justice, and I guess I appreciate whoever had the forethought to think up this system, you know, that we're moving along with here.
Thank you.
You.
All right. I said we were going to have three calls, but we're actually going to have four. Here's one from Livingston. Thank you for waiting. Go ahead.
Yes, I'm going to repeat a question I actually asked in an earlier show, which is about judicial activism. And specifically, historically, does the left or the right really have particular monopoly on this? And perhaps some of the speakers could give examples of more radical examples of activism on the left and the right. And then a second and I think related question I'm curious about is what guidance does the Constitution provide on how much judges should defer to legislative intent? And specifically, when I've gone online and looked at the record, from the congressional record on some of the laws that the Supreme Court has subsequently passed judgment, it seems as though some of the justices that are writing opinions are fairly conspicuously ignoring legislative intent that's clearly in the record. And I'm curious about what guidance there is in the Constitution. Thanks.
Okay. We've had four callers there in a row and a lot of content in those calls. Let's go back, Mark Parker, to the very first one, who asked about if the Constitution was so great in the first place, why has it been amended so many times?
Well, because it wasn't great in the first place. It had to be amended. And that's actually a point in favor of recognizing that the original document had in it a way to amend it without judicial intervention. And that was that people have either a constitutional convention or pass an amendment. Anyone that thought it was perfect would say that the original Constitution unamended is what we would want today, that would be labeled a Neanderthal, and correctly so. That's why it's been changed. That's why we look to the intent, and if we don't like it, we amend it. We don't massage it. We don't declare it living and start, jumping around and say, hey, it's living. Now it says what I want it to say.
Now, why is it on cases like Plessy, Ferguson, and Brown versus Board of Education that there wasn't an amendment but a different interpretation by a different group of people? Would you say that Plessy versus Ferguson was more original intent in the first place than was the Brown court in the second case?
Well, not really, because the Equal Protection Clause, and that's what we are talking about, is the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, and that, and the intent you have to look to there is the intent of what was passed in the Reconstruction era. And the intent in the Reconstruction era was, without any doubt, I think, an assimilation of both the South and the former slaves back into a united nation. And so Plessy versus Ferguson probably was contrary to the intent of the Equal Protection Clause.
Well, you can't nod, Kyle, on the radio. You have to.
I suppose that's true. I guess I would just point out that actually most of the people who have looked at the history of the language of the 14th Amendment and the proposed amendments in Congress to what became the 14th Amendment would say actually segregation of public schools was not aimed at by the 14th Amendment. The folks who voted on that meant for schools to stay segregated.
Mm-hmm.
And that what changed was essentially the beliefs of the citizens 100 years later, that we began to realize that the grand language of equal rights before the law and equal protection of rights couldn't for us mean segregated schools.
I've heard people say such things as, Southerners say such things as realizing how many black Americans fought and died in World War II changed their mind about all of this. Would you acknowledge, Mark, at all that changing dynamics of history and of American life might influence how someone interprets the Constitution? I'm sure you would.
Of course. I mean, you have to recognize that's a problem. But no, you have to recognize that reality. But in terms of legislative intent, one caller asked about that, and it goes along with this a little bit. Judge Scalia says he doesn't read it. He brushes through it. And that is actually in accordance with recognized principle of contract law in some respects. If I have a secret intent different than what's in the words of a contract, my secret intent is irrelevant. It's whatever deal I made. And the Constitution was sort of the deal between the government and its people. And so when the government says, okay, well, let's let's massage this deal and make it a living deal, then I'm a little concerned.
But what is it in the intent of the secret convention that you find should be looked at when, and I agree with you, I'm confused by what Justice Scalia says about legislative intent. He doesn't look at it. He says if the legislators can't put it down squarely and understandably, forget it. They don't get what they meant to put down. He's not going to look to their intent, and yet he continually tries to look for intent of folks dead for several hundred years.
I'm glad you came. I'll clear that up for you.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
There are two relevant intents. There are two intents, one irrelevant, one relevant. In a contract, and Kyle, you know this better than I because you probably booked contract law, the subjective intent of the people to the contract is wholly irrelevant, what they had on their minds. But what the people of the day would have thought that contract meant, in other words, the objective, reasonable person, that's the important intent. And so the Constitution, what any one drafter may have thought, is not that important. And it was a secret convention, but the discussion and debate over its ratification was far from secret. It was far from secret. The Federalist Papers were spread far and wide. The debate raged for years. It was a matter of give and take, and Jefferson wouldn't sign on until there was a Bill of Rights. Mm-hmm. Rhode Island wasn't even at the convention. So the fact that it was penned in secret is irrelevant. It was ratified in a public forum. What did the public view that document as meaning on that day?
Some people didn't even think we needed a written Bill of Rights. I mean, it was Madison who, mm-hmm. I think, who said, well, if these are important, you got to write them down.
Well, we basically don't have one. I mean, it's been created by the Supreme Court out of the 14th Amendment. The Bill of Rights, as Kyle said, did not apply to the states. The states could have restricted all the speech they want. They could have started a religion had they wanted to. They could have done all those things under the original Constitution. It was the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment that has been massaged into applying the Bill of Rights to the states.
You wouldn't want to go ahead.
That's because the Supreme Court back in the 1800s wrote the Privileges or Immunities Clause out of the 14th Amendment. But that's another issue that I don't understand in terms of original intent. When you're looking to figure out what original intent is when you're deciding whether what a state has done is constitutional, what do you look to? Do you look to what the Reconstructionist folks thought at that time the Bill of Rights meant, or do you look to what Jefferson and Madison and Hamilton and all of those folks thought that the Bill of Rights meant?
Well, you have a bad... Well, I think the question posed is this. When we apply the Bill of Rights to the states, which it was never meant to apply, do we apply it as it was intended by the people that lived when the Bill of Rights was ratified? Or do we apply it when the Supreme Court adopted the idea of incorporation of the Bill of Rights that applies to the states?
Do you think incorporation, and that's probably a term we should explain here in a minute, but... Better explain it. Incorporation is the idea that the 14th Amendment, when it was adopted and ratified after the Civil War, meant to take the Bill of Rights, or at least the first eight parts of the Bill of Rights, and apply them to the states. And what had happened was we had a huge shift in politics. When the Constitution was originally written and ratified, it was a lot of people in different states who were afraid of an overreaching federal government. After the Civil War, it was a lot of people who wanted the federal government to take control because they were really afraid that the states, particularly the southern states, would not give rights to the blacks that had just we'd fought a civil war over. And so the idea is that what the ratifiers of the Reconstructionist amendments, particularly the 14th Amendment, meant to accomplish was to take the Bill of Rights and to apply it to the states. And so my question is, though, at that time it's fairly clear they felt, those folks felt, that the Bill of Rights meant something a lot different than perhaps Jefferson and Madison thought it meant. So whose intent are we searching for when we purport to be searching for original intent?
Well, we have to engage in the fallacy of incorporation, regrettably, And at that point, I guess we might as well pick the, I would say the people, I would say we should have the same intent applied to the Bill of Rights, whether or not we have it applied to a state or the federal government. So as a matter of constitutional convenience, we should use the same intent, that of the original ratifiers.
See, and to me that doesn't make much sense, because if the 14th Amendment really meant to accomplish what those folks who wrote it and ratified it wanted, they wanted to accomplish something much different than did the framers. They wanted to accomplish, for example, equal rights for black citizens. And
yeah,
clearly the framers had no I shouldn't say they had no interest in that, but they worked a compromise where they left us with the horror of slavery and left it for a later Americans to deal with.
Didn't Jefferson want to deal with, well, it wasn't in the Constitution, it was in the Declaration
of
Independence he wanted to deal with. In the general context of philosophy, which we're not into at the moment, but it is relevant, when people argue about determinism as opposed to free will in human beings, some people will say, well, in the grand scheme of things, there is no free will. We're all part of a predetermined universe, but we can't live that way. We have to live as if we had free will. There's no way we could live as if we were totally determined. Does that relate to this conversation? Don't we have to live as if we knew what the Constitution means, even though people on various sides of it might say, I have the slightest idea of what the original intent was, but we can't say that. We have to arrive at a judgment.
Well, sorry, go ahead, Mark.
I agree. It's like the terms night and day. There, I can take a group of 1,000 people, put them on the sidewalk, watch the sun go down, and say, put your hands up. As soon as it's not day anymore, lower your hand. And at a point, 500 of them will have their hands up, and 500 will have their hands down.
But what about a term like due process?
And at that point, I have therefore proven that the term day and night don't mean anything? No. We still have to struggle to find out what the intent of words are, mm-hmm. even though at the margin we have a difficult time.
Mm-hmm.
That's the same way with due process. It's a difficult task. But to just abandon it and say, no, I don't have to worry about it anymore. It's a living, shaking thing. No, we can't do that.
But see, what I'm saying is we're not abandoning due process. It's a wonderful, broad term, and it's for us in our times to define what process is due to someone in a fair and just legal system.
Yeah, but as soon as we say, well, it's in our times, I fear we abandon our historical roots, and mischief and anarchy are, well, I don't mind anarchy, but mischief is afoot.
Yeah.
I think we have to know where the strike zone is. I think we have to know you go first, second, third, and base. I think we have to know what a touchdown is.
You keep confusing football and baseball in my mind. If you could stay with one sport, Mark,
okay.
It would help. We have a caller on the line from Billings and from Buffalo. Go ahead, Billings, you're first.
Well, I find the discussion intriguing again. Tallulah Bankhead's father once commented that if you could quote the Bible and Shakespeare and knew how to play craps, you had all you needed for a good liberal education. And I do pretty well with the first two, but I fail miserably on rolling the dice.
Well, these guys are specialists at that here.
Don't bet the hard eight. You'll do okay.
Well, this is why I can't function as a lawyer, but I am somewhat astounded. I occasionally thumb through Justice Douglas's book, Points of Rebellion, and I'm hearing this argument brought up allegedly out of strict constructionist on whether the Bill of Rights, as if it were a separate document, was meant to apply to the states. I believe these are amendments to the Constitution rather than an emendation. And there was a document called the Articles of Confederation prior to the formation of the Constitution, which was totally inadequate and had failed utterly. I haven't heard anyone arguing that we should have a weaker federal government since September 11th. And I'm curious as to whether or not we are actually looking at not so much a strict constructionist argument in these states' rights schemes as we are trying to find some justification for loosening the control of the power of the people from whom we said in the Declaration of Independence all these powers should justly be derived. And I will hang up and listen to your comment. I'm glad to see that there is a whiff of estrogen and a lot of common sense coming in from at least some of the folk there.
Mark, I think you should take that personally. We're going to move on to Buffalo for another comment from a listener. Go ahead.
Yes. To sort of follow along on that question, I have a question that has to do with the intent of the founders of the folks who got together and proposed this constitution. The first was that it was set up about by the Continental Congress to amend the Articles of Confederation. That was the purpose of the convention. And as to the intent of the founders, well, it seems to me that the preamble kind of lays out what the intent of the Constitution is and how it should be looked at for an interpretation. Maybe that isn't a strictly legal part of the Constitution. Maybe it isn't the part that affects creation of various things like the presidency and the Congress and the various duties and so on and so. But it certainly does lay out the intent of the founders, the spirit in which the words should be interpreted. And it seems to me that the meanings in the Constitution should provide more freedoms for people from oppressive governments, which is what we had just finished fighting at that time, a greatly, humongously oppressive government, and that there should be less interpretation which provides for oppression and control of people's lives by the government. So, you know, those are the intents of the founders. The intents were to do away with oppression of people and to establish freedoms for people. And as far as, you know, activism is concerned, activism on the right, I think, was humongously mischievous when a federal judge declared that a corporation was a person. Corporation isn't a person. It's a combine of persons who get together to do something. But it isn't a person. But this fellow established a terrible mischief, which now says that corporations have the right to say anything they want, just like a person does. Well, I mean, I can see where the persons within the corporation would, but, you know, there's an example of judicial activism that's tremendously mischievous. Anyway,
thank you.
That's what I had to say. Thank
okay,
you.
Was that decision, was it late in the last century or early in this century? Excuse me, the late 19th or early 20th century that decision came down that in some cases, at least, corporations are persons when it comes to the law?
I'm not aware of any particular decision. If he's talking in terms of the federal constitution, there's still a big argument among the Supreme Court justices which particular rights corporations are entitled to.
There was a decision upon which the explanation still hangs that corporations are when they are in court, they are individuals. Just as a person is an individual.
Well, corporations, actually the first corporation was Oxford University. Most people recognize that historically. And so from a state law perspective, articles of incorporation creating the fiction of this person that can sue, be sued, pay taxes, right, all that has been around for years, and I don't think anyone has created too much problem over it.
It has to deal with First Amendment rights, though. If the corporation has First Amendment rights like a person does.
Corporations have been given First Amendment rights like people. However, there's rights they don't have. They can't vote. They don't have a right against self-incrimination.
Or excessive bail
because they can't be incorporated. So they've kind of picked some rights and not picked some rights.
All right.
Actually, there's a fairly recent decision out of the Montana Supreme Court. I believe it's Justice Nelson who has taken on, under the Montana Constitution, the issue of should a corporation have certain of rights, including the individual right to privacy, which lets corporations invoke, for example, trade secrets and avoid parts of Montana's very broad-reaching right to know. That's a question that he disagrees with his fellow justices on, and just as there's been a lot of disagreement among the federal Supreme Court justices as to which particular rights corporations are entitled to invoke on behalf of the corporate entity as opposed to the individuals within the corporation.
Scott, do you have any comments to add here before we go on to our next call?
Well, there's been so many good questions raised, and I'm afraid that we've not addressed all of them. Probably never do, but I guess I'd like to just go back to the second caller from Laurel, who was asking about the First Amendment and its insurance of separation of church and state, because it keeps coming up. You know, it's we run into it every Christmas season.
And we have a program scheduled down the road in this series dealing with the Bush proposal for religious organizations participating in providing social welfare services in the country. We're waiting for the government to get sort of organized before we have a program on this, so we know just what we're talking about. But that is relevant. We will have a program on it.
Well, and I just wanted to respond with something I had run across of Madison speaking, who, of course, you know, was such a key player in the construction of the Bill of Rights. He said, "We are teaching the world a great truth, that governments do better without kings and nobles than with them. The merit will be doubled by the other lesson. The religion flourishes in great purity without than with the aid of government." And I think... you know, these are arguments that are ongoing. We get calls to our office from Miles City a lot, sure. Where people take issue with that and think that if you're not a Christian, what are you doing here? Sure. That argument, to me, Mark, sort of drives home why it is a living Bill of Rights, that there's a need to constantly observe what the intent was, what the discussion was, and what its implications are for us, even if it is not a majoritarian opinion.
Well, I couldn't agree more. But remember what you just said. I see the Bill of Rights. It's important to protect the Establishment Clause. In other words, the government shouldn't establish religion. And you said it's important to observe the intent. The fact of the matter is, if we weren't certain that Madison meant that the church and state have to be separated, you would not be armed with anything when you got down to Miles City, because if you got down to Miles City with a living constitution, what you would have in your hands is, hey, the times have changed, man. These are all Christians down here, and they want this, and what harm is it, and what are you doing down here? All you go to Miles City with, and I agree with the ACLU on this 100%, the only thing you take down with you is a copy of the Constitution and Madison's intent, and say, we are here because we don't think that there should be an encroachment of church and state. They shouldn't mix. If it wasn't for original intent, you'd be coming home with a couple of burgers from the Range Riders, and that's it. So I...
I take issue with that, because I think that there are people in that community who absolutely do not view themselves as wanting to promote religion through government, but
there are
cowed.
Troublemakers everywhere.
However,
well, but they're
but
cowed
if,
by.
If you wanted to go with the majority, if you wanted to go with the trend, if you wanted to go with the socially acceptable, if you wanted to go with the new mores down there, you'd leave the Bill of Rights in the courthouse lawn. But if you wanted to go with the dead Constitution and what Madison was saying about it, you win.
Well, there's a very practical consideration here that may not be constitutional, but it's important to consider, and that is, in almost every country with an official state religion, the official state church is empty for most of the time. The thriving religions are the ones that are not the official state religions.
Well, of course. Yeah. Of course.
Kyle?
Well, I suppose I should make a couple of comments. What Mark said there about...
I thought that'd get somebody going.
The difference between a living and a dead Constitution, you know, of course we all honor the words of the Constitution. The question is, how do you apply those words today? And I think, actually, we go down to Miles City, having gone there and done it, actually, with more protection than just Madison and Jefferson, because what the folks come back with is Justice Rehnquist saying, oh, no. What Madison meant was just we wouldn't have a national religion, but everything else goes. And I think he's just absolutely wrong on that.
Of course he was wrong.
Yeah, the point, of course, he was wrong, and he says he's reading original intent into the Establishment Clause.
And so are you, and you're disagreeing on the meaning of original intent?
Absolutely. We're disagreeing on it, and
okay,
that's my point.
Okay, but we both agree we look at original intent.
No, I'm saying I'm looking at the words of the Constitution and building from them as opposed to looking for, well, what did it mean in 1787?
You're absolutely right. I can leave.
While you guys okay. Calm down, we're going to go to a caller from Billings. You're on the air.
I don't know if I want to get in this baseball game or not.
Or football.
Yeah, or tackle.
Scrum.
There were a couple of things on NPR today that really caught my attention. And the first of them, well, the second one was the one tonight where the man said about the humongous kinds of errors made by the British when they were occupying our country, and how we took such umbrage at that, and we certainly stand up and say, hooray, they didn't let the British get us down. I heard the to the point today, the one of the high officials from the Palestine organization say that the thing that has rankled with him ever since he was 12 years old, and he's evidently in his 60s now, is the fact that they have been occupied by a foreign country. And this, the way in which he said that just really rang with me. And I wonder, you know, how is it that we were so against the occupation of the British centuries ago, and we're so in favor of the occupation of the Palestinians now? So, what do you all think?
We were the British 2 centuries ago.
I don't know if I'm in favor of occupation right now. I have not addressed the issue. I didn't come prepared to address it.
We have a call on the line from Missoula. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, I was calling. I had a comment to make about the gentleman who was talking about going to Miles City with the nothing but the Constitution and the sheer text about the separation of church and state. There's a real divergence of opinions about the separation of church and state as to interpreting it. And one interpretation is that that clause was specifically directed at preventing a federal adoption of a church. Whereas the argument is a lot of the original states had official religious governments, and you know, that's definitely a lively argument for interpretation. And I also think one of the real good things to get to is the framers' intent was all about to prevent tyranny, and you have to get to a real structuralist argument about that to analyze the structure of the Constitution.
Okay.
And that's about what I wanted to say.
Thank you. Would you comment on that comment?
Well, it does. I mean, Congress, the First Amendment does say Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. And as Kyle was saying, that was expanded by the Civil War amendments to include states. So that's how you get down to Miles City. And that's how you get down and take up with a state's action.
Well, and you get to our state constitution, which is even more explicit. Right. So I think the structuralist, if I understand what the other part of the question was, I mean, it's that separation of powers that protects us from the tyranny of any one branch of government stomping on the rights of any of the citizens, or at least theoretically. We see, you know, right now we see a real threat to the Fourth Amendment, or what's left of it, because of the war sentiments that are taking hold of the discussion in Congress right now. But when I hear that Representative Barr is considered a civil libertarian because he's saying let's put the brakes on giving away the farm here, talking about allowing electronic surveillance and wiretapping of citizens by the CIA with secret information being withheld, I think that it reminds us exactly why we need that separation. And if Congress just walks lockstep with the executive branch, then, you know, we better pray that the that the courts are there to protect us.
Will Bob Barr be speaking to an ACLU national meeting soon?
You never know. You never know. We were always known for our strange bedfellows.
I would like to get shortly into the Bush versus Gore issue, but if anyone wants to bring up anything else before we get to that.
I'd actually like to answer one of the questions that was asked.
Go ahead.
The poor fellow who called in and said he's asked it twice now.
Okay.
I think this is the one who asked the question about judicial activism and has there been a monopoly by the left or the right? And that is actually a very interesting question. The very first act of judicial activism was by what became what we'd call today the Republican Party, the Federalists at that time, as the Adams administration was leaving office. They made what they called the midnight appointments and gave a bunch of judgeships and such to Federalists, as Jefferson was coming in, who would want Republicans at that time, in office. And that went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and it was the famous case of Marbury versus Madison, where a Federalist justice, John Marshall, who many consider to be one of the greatest ever Supreme Court justices, engaged in an incredible bit of judicial activism. He decided that the Supreme Court had the right to review the acts of Congress and, if necessary, declare them unconstitutional. He did not declare the particular act in question unconstitutional, but he established the whole idea of judicial review, and that is not in the Constitution.
Now, why I've always wondered, and both lawyers here I'm sure know the answer to this, why didn't somebody in the legislative or the executive branch say, just how many divisions do you have, Mr. Chief Justice? I mean, that question of how can you enforce this? It's just your opinion.
Andrew Jackson did it about 30 years later or so, when John Marshall, at the end of his career, decided the case, was Georgia versus someone, I can't think of the name of it at the moment, but in any event, it was about the Cherokee Nation. And clearly the Constitution gives the right for commerce between with the Indian nations and treaties with the Indian nations to the federal government. Mm-hmm. And the state of Georgia decided no, it wasn't going to stand by a treaty that the federal government had adopted because, the usual story, gold had been found. And so Georgia found it that they wanted to move the Cherokees out of the state. And the Cherokee sued. It went up to the Supreme Court, and Justice Marshall said, you can't do that, Georgia. You have no power under the Constitution. What you have done is unconstitutional. And President Jackson said, John Marshall has made his decision. Let him enforce it. Mm-hmm. Of course, the court has no power to enforce. And what came out of that was what's known as the Trail of Tears, where the Cherokees were sent off to Oklahoma. Many, many died. And it's really one of the great blights on constitutional history.
But that doesn't answer my question. How come Marshall prevailed, ultimately?
How come he prevailed as to
his
judicial review?
Yeah,
I think
the
people accepted it, and then certainly in our times, in the 50s, when we had the same thing happen, a governor say, "This is what I'm going to do," standing in front of the door of the University of Mississippi and saying, "You're to the black students, you're not coming in here," and the question was, would the Brown versus Board of Education case be enforced by the executive branch? President Eisenhower decided it would, send in the 101st Airborne, and I don't think anyone would suggest today that was the wrong decision, that in fact the very way our whole constitutional society has developed requires judicial review and requires an executive to follow what the judiciary holds. And I think we saw it last year when the judiciary, I think many, many of us thought what they did in Bush v. Gore was just wrong and that there was no real authority to do it. Nevertheless,
the judiciary you're talking about is the Florida Supreme Court?
No, I'm talking about the U.S. Supreme Court. We may disagree on which particular. But in any event, no one suggested we were going to have rioting in the streets or anything like that. We accepted the notion of judicial review, even though we disagreed with the particular decision.
Go ahead.
Well, on that point, 2 years ago during the Freeman trial, Leroy Schweitzer declared himself the Supreme Court Justice of the state of Montana. And he was in front of Judge Kuhnauer, and they were arguing over their respective authority a little bit. And the argument went like this. Leroy Schweitzer said, well, the only reason you're a judge is because the marshal there with a gun will obey you and not me. And Judge Kuhnauer said, that's right. And that was the end of that constitutional debate, the monopoly of power. Whoever has the guns, if they obey somebody, that person has the power. And by just sheer tradition in this country, people have followed Supreme Court orders. Thank goodness.
Yeah.
If they didn't, we'd be in trouble.
Well, it's probably the least democratic aspect of our society.
But it's final.
Yeah.
It's final. It is the end. We know that there's the end.
But imagine somebody based on a theory of democracy appointing someone to a life term.
Good behavior. Go ahead.
Yeah, on good behavior, which can be loosely interpreted and has been. And then saying that they have the final word, public policy.
Well,
the answer is it's for the most part worked for us. And what's the other answer? If you let the legislature decide, you're going to have the tyranny of the majority, which is one of the reasons you have a constitution.
Well, now some would say we had the tyranny of the majority in the Bush-Gore decision.
5-4.
Yes, and I want to talk about that. Let's go to a caller from Helena first, and then get into that. Helena, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to comment on the authority question. You know, that's way, way, way back. That's always been the basis for the law, no matter what. If you give somebody the authority, if you knuckle under and give them the authority, then that's the law, no matter what else. And, you know, it's true in Russia today. It was true in Russia years ago. It's true in the USA today. It was true in Europe in the 13th century. It's exactly the point. You know, I mean, if you give somebody authority, then they have it. They have the authority. And or if you don't, no matter what the law says, no matter what the court says, no matter what the Constitution says. The law is how it actually happens, and it is that very issue of whose authority do you recognize?
Well, stay on the line for a moment, because there is a question there about whether it is organized force or whether it is citizen power. Mm-hmm. And we've had a caller on this program, not on this program, but on Your Opinion, Please, suggest that if citizens had been armed on those airplanes that flew into the into the Twin Towers in New York, there wouldn't have been any, because they wouldn't, the people wouldn't have gotten away with taking over the planes. Now, that would be individual citizens capable of acting on their own and having the wherewithal to do it, as opposed to the terrorists who took authority from the established authority on that plane, which was the pilot and the navigator. Listener, would you comment on that observation?
Well, that to me, that is the very issue. But, of course, the guy with the gun that starts shooting holes in the airplane, why they're going to crash the plane anyway.
Well, we've had that discussion, too, and some people say that...
the thing is, you're exactly right there. And I think that's one of the things we ought to be doing is training or allowing our people and encouraging our people to go ahead and take, in those situations... Take the law into your own hand, or that is to say, it's mob action, I guess, but that's part of how we do protect ourselves.
Why wouldn't they be enforcing existing law if they were resisting terrorists?
Well, it doesn't matter. In that
citizens do have the right to enforce the law, I think, don't they, in this country?
Well, that's what they say, that you can do a citizen's arrest, but mm-hmm. I don't think it holds up in court, however.
Okay. All right. Okay.
But no, I do believe that follows exactly with the idea of if you grant them the authority to hijack you, then they will, you know, and whether you're armed or whether you're just willing to, quote, give your life, so to speak.
Which some did,
And take that initiative. I mean, that's what we're all about, as far as I'm concerned, is being willing and able to take the initiative. And sometimes we're right, sometimes we're wrong, and I guess that's part of what our education is about, is to try to teach us right and wrong in terms of not morality, but in terms of just social justice and social action.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. We've had cases in this state, more than in most, in fact, about people who challenge the right of the government to exercise power over their lives, and they've sort of declared themselves independent in one way or another of law that has been passed by legislators or by the Congress, and law that has been accepted by the courts and enforced by the administration. And if Mark's case is right, of the sitting judge in the trial actually having the power because the bailiff was sitting there willing to enforce it, doesn't that justify anybody who has the means? I'm sort of supporting the NRA here. Anybody who has the means to enforce the law that's on the books, that is supposed to be something we all live by, against people who are clearly violating that law.
I would hate to adopt that proposition as one that people should adhere to.
Well, why not?
Because we have three people here, all five in the room, but three talking about interpretation of the law. And to interpret it on the street corner with arms is going to turn out to be hazardous. I'm a Second Amendment fan, of course, but that doesn't mean you pull it out of your holster every time you see somebody breaking the law. I've actually performed a citizen's arrest once, and it was a scary proposition and gave me great appreciation for those that professionally arrest people all the time. But I'm uninterested in everyone thinking that they are deputized to enforce the law.
I'm very uninterested in that as well. Okay. And I guess what I would say is, you know,
trying to be principled here.
The idea of a constitution is, and it starts out, we the people.
Mm-hmm.
We lend our authority to the system that we set up. And the idea is, if the system goes rotten, we can take that power back.
Didn't the Freemen think they were doing that?
Well, sure. That was that was an acknowledgement of the saying, you are not sovereign over me. But gratefully, it didn't have a mass appeal. And, you know, when it does, we get back to the Jefferson notion that we ought to have a revolution.
A little rebellion's good to
shake things up.
Sure. And doesn't a little rebellion on Jefferson's suggestion there, doesn't that speak for a living constitution? Or isn't that what he's referring to?
No.
Okay.
No.
All right. Let's talk about Bush versus Gore. Some people would say that we have an appointed president by a very slim majority of the U.S. Supreme Court, in which five people who have one fundamental view of life and our system and the Constitution prevailed over four other people who have quite a different view. And they also point out that in the course of debate and argument within the court, there was an occasion, in fact, when Justice Scalia made reference to, if something happened from the other side, it would narrow George Bush's chances of prevailing. And then a justice from the other side made the same observation in another context about the chances of Al Gore prevailing, so that they sounded on occasion like they were speaking for the two political camps in their debate. Were they?
Probably.
Yes.
Well, let's go home.
Although I think one of the major points that arises out of Bush v. Gore, along with recognizing that, and hopefully it's the rare case, that it is so political, there's just no way around it. But the point is, I do not understand how Justice Scalia and to a lesser extent Justices Rehnquist and Thomas can possibly live with themselves and stand up again in front of a crowd and say, I believe in original intent, because there's not a shred of original intent in the decision that is Bush v. Gore.
Let me ask you, I don't want to go home yet because we have 25 minutes of program left here. Why didn't the Supreme Court insist that the Florida Supreme Court carry out its responsibility?
That's a very good question. That is, in fact, what Justice Souter thought he had Justice Kennedy convinced on, that what they would do is send the case back and say, okay, we're going to tell you, here the standard is, you have to treat every vote the same. Mm-hmm. Now go ahead and do it. Figure out how to do it. And that, I think most people think, would have been the correct outcome. From what I've heard and what I've read, the reason is, along with the cynical reason, that they just wanted Bush to win because they wanted their successors to be appointed by someone who had the same judicial philosophy. But they really did not believe in the Constitution. They were afraid that if this issue were thrown to the Congress, that we'd have a revolution in the country, riots in the streets or something. And I really think that does not speak well to their belief in our constitutional system. I think if it had gone to the Congress, it would have been a very interesting debate. And we would have come through it one way or the other with either Al Gore or George Bush as our president. But it would have been the way that the Constitution reads. And maybe, Mark, here we're differing on who is an original intent person.
Could somebody tell me why, when the Florida Constitution states that if somebody wins an election by less than one half of 1% of the vote, there will be a statewide recount, that there was no statewide recount? And the Secretary of State gave the local Board of Supervisors the option of simply reaffirming their original count or recounting votes. That's not constitutional from my point of view. And why didn't the Florida Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court say there will be a recount, because that's what the Florida Constitution calls for?
Well, the Florida Supreme Court, under the system of states' rights, gets to decide what Florida law is, and I don't think anyone raised that issue. The Florida Supreme Court did, in its final decision, say we're going to have a recount, a statewide recount of all the overvotes, undervotes. I can't remember which one it was.
That's not what the Florida Constitution
says. But it wasn't a total statewide recount.
Sure.
It's a good question, but it's one that we'll never know the answer to, because the five justices on the U.S. Supreme Court decided not to let the system work through it.
I, of course, disagreed.
Well, let me get to Mark in just a moment after I give our phone numbers. I assumed that Mark was not going to let that go by without comment. We have a telephone number here in the Billings area of 657-2941. If you'd like to talk about the Bush-Gore decision of the U.S. Supreme Court or bring up a totally new subject, you may do that as well. And outside of the Billings area, 1-800-441-2941. 1-800-441-2941, if you especially want to comment about the Supreme Court's appointment, as some people would say, of President Bush. Would you like to comment on that highly prejudicial statement I just made, Mark?
Well, listening to the debate between Marvin Granger and Kyle Gray on the issue of Bush versus Gore is like listening to my kids argue over whether or not there should be a raise in allowance. The resolution of the debate is pretty much foretold. I think Bush versus Gore is a rare decision in jurisprudence, probably for which it will not ever probably be cited for president as precedent for any proposition, unless we're faced with another very odd national situation. And its constitutional underpinnings are going to be the matter of great debate for years. But I do think that I got a chuckle out of seeing Judge Scalia rely on Reynolds versus Sims. Reynolds versus Sims was the one man, one vote decision that kind of enabled the remedy of Baker versus Carr to come about. Considered to be Earl Warren's worst hour, it was what almost caused him his impeachment, I think.
My neighbor had impeachment.
And Baker versus Carr, Reynolds versus Sims are routinely, habitually, chronically, and pathologically challenged by all constitutional thinkers of my ilk. But guess what pops up in Bush versus Gore for the power of the Supreme Court to intercede, and that is Reynolds versus Sims. Reynolds versus Sims, though, actually is a proper constitutional predicate and leads you to the result in Bush versus Gore and what I think to be a proper constitutional decision if you buy into Reynolds versus Sims in the first instance, which some of us really don't. So once you empower the federal government to wander around aimlessly in state elections, which Reynolds versus Sims did, then you end up with problems. You end up with people on the court that you don't like it when they get into your house with these tools that you've created by abandoning original intent. So if you like original intent, and come to my side, you'll never see another Bush versus Gore, because they picked up the weapons. Bush versus Gore court picked up the weapons created by the people that believe in a living constitution, and they turned them on the creators.
Kyle, I see you're nodding again. You can't do that on the radio. Go ahead.
Actually, I was shaking my head and somewhat. I was laughing at. In fact, I underlined Reynolds versus Sims here in my copy of Bush v. Gore. It is. It's a fascinating decision in the sense of just if you can stand back and not take a part in it and just look at how it worked. You have all the states' rightists deciding, oh, no, the Equal Protection Clause really means a lot more than it ever did before. And
hey, what's a living constitution?
And turn it into a living constitution. And you have the other four justices who, for example, hate Justice Scalia's reading of the 11th Amendment and states' rights and all that, saying, we got to let Florida decide. That's We've right. got to let sure. Florida decide. Yeah. And it really is just it's bizarre, but... But I do think that you cannot use Reynolds v. Sims to get where Justice Scalia, actually Justice Rehnquist,
if you view it as a living document, if you view it as a living document,
you cannot use any constitutional principle to get where.
Yes,
you, where
we have
you,
again.
In,
while you guys
Bush
calm
figure.
Down, we have a caller on the line from Bozeman. You're on the air.
Hi. It occurs to me that every citizen has to take a stand on these sort of things, and in fact, I did that. I was called to jury duty in California a few months ago, and during the voir dire, said that I would refuse to serve. And the judge lifted his eyebrows magnificently and said, what do you mean? I said, I think this is an illegitimate procedure, and he asked me why, and I said, I think everybody here, you, Your Honor, should have resigned your commission in protest against Bush v. Gore. For that, I spent 9.5 days in jail and was called to his chambers and given a chance at last to explain myself. I think that the United States Supreme Court has entirely delegitimized itself, and in doing that, the entire jurisprudential system. How can I possibly, as a citizen who believes in the Constitution, or used to, who believes in the Supreme Court, or used to, be impaneled in a jury under the aegis of the Supreme Court and of all other courts, when I think, in fact, that the entire system is fixed? I will hang up and let you guys discuss this. Thank you.
Is the system fixed in the way he describes?
Regrettably not. I find that I'm always getting ruled against and not getting my way. The system isn't fixed. I regret anyone that doesn't want to serve on jury duty. It's the one thing I won't help somebody do. I've had people in this town that think they're movers and shakers and wheelers and dealers, close friends of mine, call up and say, Mark, can you get me out of jury duty? What do I do? And I'd lecture them like I lecture a baby. Sure. I said, you son of a gun. I use Tom language. Yeah. I said, you're going to get out of jury duty, and next week you're going to be I'm going to be having a drink with you, and you're going to be complaining about these stupid juries.
Mm-hmm.
You drop everything you're doing. You get down there and serve. It's the best thing you'll ever do for your business. You think your business is important, then you ought to serve on a jury once, and because everything you do might be judged by a jury someday.
And I just found it to be a tremendously educational experience, personally.
I've got zero tolerance for someone that wants to get out of a jury duty, and regrettably that means the caller, too, and I don't want to get too rambunctious with someone calling in, but serve on juries, people. Don't try to get out of it. I have never yet met a juror that didn't come away from the experience extraordinarily impressed, more impressed by the system than when they went in.
Well, I can't say I was more impressed by the system than when I went in, but I did find it a very educational experience about human nature as much as about the law.
mean, well, and in the gentleman's defense, too am a big fan of our jury system. I think it has flaws, but it's better than anything else we could come up with. But what he has said is precisely what Justice Stevens said in his dissenting decision in Bush v. Gore, which I can read it if you like. He said, the endorsement of the position of the majority of this court can only lend credence to the most cynical appraisal of the work of judges throughout the land. It is confidence in the men and women who administer the judicial system that is the true backbone of the rule of law. Time will one day heal the wound to that confidence that will be inflicted by today's decision. One thing, however, is certain. Although we may never know with complete certainty the identity of the winner of this year's presidential election, election. The identity of the loser is perfectly clear. It is the nation's confidence in the judge as an impartial guardian of the rule of law. And I think that's precisely what the caller was suggesting.
Mark?
Had that decision been for Al Gore, I suggest that I would be reading that in provision instead of Kyle Gray. Mm-hmm. We view these things from our own political perspective. Right. Although I have to admit that having read Bush versus Gore, the lawyer in me, not the politician, would say that the actual constitutional doctrine set forth in there might be a bit of a stretch, but not near the stretch I've seen in other decisions. So.
Okay. Scott, you have a comment?
Well, yeah, not to lose sight of the importance of the Supreme Court here, but let's get back to the 14th Amendment that guarantees the rights of black people in particular, and Florida in particular, to have their votes count. And I think that the cynicism that we're talking about is based in reality. When you see how it's not the absentee votes or the overseas votes, in my mind, that tipped that election. It was a systematic disenfranchisement of black votes that tipped that election. And to me, that's as much an embarrassment as what the court did.
But that also took place in Cook County, Illinois. In fact, in Cook County, Illinois, more black votes were not counted than in any county in Florida in this last election, thrown out for some kind of impropriety. Now, what is that? Is our election system not permitting certain, in other words, you have to be, what, educated, middle class, and white to do the thing properly? And what does that mean?
Well, I think it means a couple of things, and one is why it's so important to see that the 14th Amendment applies to states. That I think racism is still entrenched in political systems. And as long as you can count on minority votes to be on your side, then let's count them. And if you can't count on them being on your side, then let's disenfranchise them. Now, that's a cynical view, and I'm not necessarily reflecting ACLU's view in saying that.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying as a student of civil rights, it seems apparent to me that we have afforded, the modern counting systems to the rich suburbs and the antiquated flawed card punch systems, if you can even get, your name to be recognized as a legitimate voter. So to the poor community. So I think we got a long way to go, and that's why I say this is an experiment in democracy. We've made some enormous inroads, but we still got a long way to go to where everybody is treated equally.
Now, Florida has amended their law, and I don't know if they've dealt with this problem, but there was a long, long list of felons. Turned out not to be an accurate list at all.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't correct that on election day, but could that happen again, I wonder, in Florida? I mean, that's a very serious question. Legal question, it seems to me.
Well and Florida also engaged in an unconstitutional decision on that very issue. They decided that they were going to say that felons from, say, Montana, who the people of Montana, through our Constitution, have decided after a certain time get their civil rights back and are entitled to vote. They then moved to Florida. And the Florida Supreme Court, or, well, not the Florida Supreme Court, the Florida administrative folks, and Catherine Harris et al. Decided that they were going to say, oh, well, if you were a felon in Montana, we won't let you vote in Florida. And the courts told them again and again, you can't do that, and they continued to do it.
But the New York Times says a lot of felons on that list were never felons anywhere.
Well, they should have been. Yeah. They wanted to be felons. If we're going to take this conversation to Florida, the manner in which some of those recounts was being done was so abysmal and so absolutely approaching complete anarchy that it should have been stopped. Now, whether it was constitutionally stopped, I can debate with you. But anyone that has objectively reported that mess down there, that it was a setup from the beginning to try to put Bush out of it by a sloppy and terrible recount. And luckily, the legislature moved in, and Catherine Harris moved in. But defending what took place on that recount, no one can do that.
Well, let me say something. I don't think that this Bush v. Gore decision has been lost, especially on the young people. I was in the Judith Gap School last week talking about the Bill of Rights in relation to censorship. And the first question that came out of the kids was, why is it that people who have committed crimes can't vote? And where else would this come from in these kids' minds?
Well, I think that's a good question. I think people that commit crimes and are adjudicated a felon, one thing we always tell citizens is you don't go commit crimes, you go change the system. So if we disenfranchise them as citizens, I've never quite tracked that. Why can't we tell them go exercise your right to citizenship? Don't go out and break the law, you idiot. And
I realize, Mark, that the New York Times and the Washington Post are not newspapers that probably generally agree with you politically. They did send strong teams of investigative journalists to Florida after the election, and they both came back saying there were extensive irregularities, and it was not a conspiracy, they say, against George Bush.
Extensive irregularities in the recount.
Yes, in the recount, and it largely followed from the fact that each supervisor in each county was a kind of a czar, and that the Secretary of State let that happen.
Oh, please.
Well, she did.
Let me take this out of the political realm for a minute.
Getting it into the journalistic realm.
let me ask Mark a question.
You mean the journalists that have uniformly said, had there been a recount, Bush would have won?
No, yes. He may very well have won. We're not talking about who would have won.
Yeah.
We're talking about the procedure.
Okay.
Go ahead, Kyle.
I guess my point about Bush v. Gore, I obviously think it's abhorrent. Mark doesn't. But let me say this about it. The actual decision of it, which is that we've got to count votes equally, is actually not a bad idea.
Yeah.
And I think if we could do what the majority wrote in here we can't, which is use this case as precedent and go ahead and reform our voting system so that people who vote have their vote counted, that could be a very good thing that would come out of a very otherwise bad process.
Why can't we, on the one man, one person, one vote principle, go back and say that an individual's vote in Montana, an individual's vote in Cook County, Illinois, and an individual's vote in Florida has to have the same value by federal standards?
Well, it doesn't. That's why we have the Electoral College, and the whole idea behind the original intent of the Constitution was so that each vote wouldn't have the same
I mean interpreting the outcome of that individual state.
Of how you count a vote that
well,
they
no,
should
I
be.
Mean, if we know that in certain parts of the country, it may not be racial, it may not be prejudicial, that the system is simply so inefficient.
Right.
And conducted so poorly that many people's votes aren't counted. Isn't that unconstitutional?
That's certainly what you could read Bush v. Gore to mean. And I think if we do read it that way and we use it as precedent and we use it, for example, in the cases arising out of Florida that are being brought by the ACLU and others to say how, look, we have to fix the system and count the votes and let the people vote who are entitled to vote. And go ahead and count their votes in the same way in Florida that we count them in Montana.
Well, in the
that
future,
we
should all be
California.
Striving for that, I would think.
That's right. We won't get there if we don't use the rationale that actually two of the other justices signed on to, saying, look, if we're going to say this, we've got to be serious about it. And the thing that is so disheartening about Bush v. Gore is they adopt what on its face, the five majority justices on its face, is actually a lovely idea. Let's go ahead and then count votes equally. And then they say right in the decision, but we can't use this as precedent because this is a case that will never come up again. And that's, to me, the even worse part of this decision is for them to say it only works for white Republican voters in Florida.
Oh, please.
We have two callers
please.
On the line, and we have 6 minutes left. So, Mark, you get very little time for rebuttal there, but please take it.
Oh, with Bush versus Gore?
Well, to what Kyle just said. I mean, you know.
Oh.
You were turning red with rage. I want you to communicate that, you know.
I can't communicate everything about it. I accept this. I remember in law school, the issue was equality in education. And the proposition was that every school kid everywhere should have the same education. And they asked me what the issue of the day was, and I said, is it unconstitutional for a community to pool its resources to embedder its children? And everyone said, oh, yeah, that's fine. And I said, well, no, you all have said it isn't, because if a community tries to make its children better, If there are children in another community that aren't as good, their system is unconstitutional and they have to shut it out. Same way with nationalizing the election. If I and my neighbors want to get together and have a absolutely perfect electoral process, good ballots, good counting, good poll workers, are we supposed to stop because they down in Florida someplace, the people haven't got their act together? No, we shouldn't. We shouldn't nationalize it. We shouldn't uniform it. People that want to vote should make sure they get out of bed and put their lives together and vote.
We have a staff member here, and I've quoted her on the air before, who said, if you don't know anything about the issues, you shouldn't vote. You owe it to other people to stay home. Is that a good view?
I've never told people they should get out and vote. If they haven't, after 12 years of public education, after the media, if they don't have a sincere appreciation for this country enough to take a few hours out of their day and go vote, then they shouldn't vote.
What if they don't educate themselves about what's on the ballot? What if they don't know who's running for judge and they just pick out a name out of the...
Then they get the government they deserve. Okay. It is hard work to find out how to vote.
We have two callers and very little time. Billings, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Well, just briefly, Strick's constructionists are a form of secular fundamentalism, and I think the evidence of this is seen in the fact that those who are quite ready, as the gentleman has pointed out, to condemn people for not serving on a jury, don't ever seem to want to show up when the rather tightly strictured concepts of who ought to serve in the jury pool is brought up. I'd like him to answer why, under the Constitution, we don't have a broader and more of a peerage concept in the jury. And I'll hang up and listen.
Mark?
We should. I think that we should have a system that includes every citizen. Just taking registered voters might not be enough, but it is the only practical way we can do it. And a lot of people don't register to vote because they don't want to be on jurors.
That's right.
And I never said I was a strict constructionist. I said I believe we should look to the original intent of the Constitution as the people thought it meant. Strict constructionists, I don't even know what that means.
Well, the original intent, though, as an act of faith, you'll acknowledge, not that we can actually arrive at it, but we should try.
Like knowing where the strike zone is?
Yeah.
Like knowing good from evil?
Okay. We don't know that either, do we? Or do we?
We don't know. There are lots of propositions we'll never know, but we, as an article of faith, we try to get to them, try to get to the answer. We don't abandon it because it's tough.
Our last caller tonight is from Helena. You're on the air.
Let's see. In terms of juries, I've been called for jury duty probably 6 times in my life, and I've never been selected for a jury. So being called, and it definitely doesn't necessarily mean you get there. Secondly, on the issue of sort of the one man, one vote kind of thing, or equalizing the vote, just as an idea, when Pat Williams was representative, and I suppose Denny Rehberg is essentially in the same position now, that position represents more people than any other position in Congress. So my thinking is that on that issue, that if our representatives' votes in Congress were weighted to the number of people that they represent, then that might kick a little bit of the one, of my one man, one vote back to me a little more than what it does. And then secondly, on terms of national elections, with the kinds of things that are going now with the internet and with TVs and a person, any individual, by just calling up the telephone and punching the keypad a few times, could vote on almost any issue that they wanted to set it up that way, So I really think that's something that is very, very close to being a possibility.
Now, the guns in the airplane frightened us, all of us, and I brought it up just to see if it would. Everybody going to their computer and voting on every issue frightens me even more.
Early and often.
You're not really a Democrat? Nothing. In your heart? Is that right?
Yeah, I guess that's probably right.
We're looking for the glitchless computer system, and I think those of us who use computers know that is harder to find than original intent.
No, I don't want that either.
Yeah, well, nobody wants it because I don't know why. I don't understand why. I guess we just honestly don't believe in democracy.
democracy. We don't believe that the people know what's going on.
No, we don't believe in democracy.
Yeah, we don't trust them. We don't trust the people.
The Bill of Rights was an anti-democratic institution, and so is the Constitution. Democracy is fine, but there's no reason to be a fanatic.
But is it such a fanatic to think about having all these representatives up there creating legislation, bills, and then giving the citizens an opportunity to review those and vote on them? I mean, that puts republicanism in another kind of format, and it puts democracy kind of puts them together in another little different way, you know?
Representative democracy was a brilliant idea in the Constitution, and I think Mark and I can both agree on that.
Yeah, the reason we've survived and the reason they parrot our system is because it's marvelous. We wouldn't be here chit-chatting and going crazy and screaming at each other if it weren't for the original intent of the founders.
And our guests tonight have been very good at that. I want to thank Kyle Gray and Mark Parker for going at it so effectively and really interestingly tonight on this program. October 25th will be our next program in this series. We'll talk about the Montana Declaration of Rights versus the U.S. Bill of Rights. And we'll be talking about how they differ. And tonight's program, we appreciate all of the people who called, and thank you very much. I would like to say that tomorrow night, Your Opinion, Please, we'll be back at 6:30. Gasoline, crude oil, I should say crude oil prices dropped about 25% due to the lack of demand after the crisis of September, the horrors of September 11th. Nationally, gasoline prices have dropped 7 cents a gallon since September 11th. I'd like to know what the gas prices are in your community, because in Montana they're exactly where they were before September 11th. And let's talk about that. Report tomorrow night, if you would, at 6:30, what you're paying at the pump in your community and why we're not reflecting the market in our part of the country. We'll look forward to your joining us then. Ken Siebert at the controls tonight, Dan Eichlin on the telephone, and again, Scott, thank you very much for your participation and for your good ideas on this series.
Thanks, Marvin, and I just encourage folks to check out our website at www.aclumontana.org.
Mark, you want them to check out your website?
No.
Okay, thank you. Kyle?
I also do not have a website.
Okay, all right.
If I did, I wouldn't want anybody to look at it but
thank
me.
Thank you, thank you.
This program is supported by the UCross Foundation, providing residency and studio space for selected visual artists and writers at the historic Big Red Ranch near Sheridan, Wyoming. Phone 307-737-2291.
NPR for Montana and Northern Wyoming, KBMC Bozeman, KEMC Billings, KECC Miles City, and in Gillette, KYPR.
This program is supported by Radiant Engineering of Bozeman, providing energy-efficient radiant floor heating systems and other comprehensive energy solutions in Montana since 1979. On the web at radiantengineering.com.